find better than bacon and lettuce and homegrown tomatoes. Up in the morning, out in the garden, get you a ripe when you don't get a hard one. Plant them in the spring, eat them in the summer. All winter without them's a culinary bummer. I forget all about the sweating and digging every time I go out and pick me up there. Homegrown tomatoes, homegrown tomatoes. What'd life be without homegrown tomatoes?
Ladies and gentlemen, here we are. It is Thursday afternoon. Time for In the Garden. I'm in the studio here. This is Oren Pearson, and we've got Ed Bajarski joining us by phone. He's our region's master gardener, and he'll have lots of good info for us about best practices gardening this time of year. So, before we dive in, I want to say thank you to the Flower Farm. This Saturday is the last day of the season for their garden center there on Haugen Drive, and they do still have a wide selection of bedding plants and shrubs. And then out there at their Papke's Landing Flower Farm, the dahlias are blooming, and bouquet subscriptions and delivery are available too from the Flower Farm. They're open 10 to 5 every day but Wednesday, 6 Rory's Road, Papke's Landing. Okay, let's see if we can get Ed on the phone here. Ed, are you there?
I'm here in sunny Juneau.
Hey, sunny Juneau. Wow. So maybe sunny days are coming our way too then.
Yes. Well, certainly we enjoyed some well-needed rain, much-needed rain here. And the dust has been knocked down, and the plants are perked up, and the weeds are perked up, and the slugs, and most everything. I mean, all of us. It's good to have the sun come back after a rainy spell.
Yeah, right. Yeah. That combo, rain and sun, that'll get things growing and going.
Yes, certainly does. And they are, I mentioned, slugs and other assorted pests are multiplying with abandon. The aphids are working, I mean, multiply faster than rabbits, since all it takes is one aphid, and suddenly you have a whole bunch of aphids. And coming soon to a currant or gooseberry bush near you, will be the imported currant worm. So there's all sorts of stuff perking up. And even, I know Petersburg has more of a deer problem than elsewhere, but here I've noticed the bottom branches of my apple trees are being browsed a bit.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, a little, they're the, I mean, of the whole bunch I've mentioned, they're definitely the tastiest pest.
Well, that's true. Oh, my. Got me thinking about currant worm flavors. Yikes.
Yeah, we can make, we make some nice currant jelly to go with a nice venison roast. I mean,
sure.
Some of the garlic scapes are happening, and they all go well together.
Well, that's true. That's true. It's a whole forest of food there in our gardens. So if we find our gardens, you know, invaded by this or that pest, let's say aphids, what can we do?
Okay. So the first thing really is observation. You know, get out in your garden. I mean, I walk the garden how many times a day. And I was over at another lady's house today, checking out, do a little pruning out some branches and dead stuff, among other things. And it started looking at her currant bushes, which were, they didn't have the currant worms yet, which is what I was expecting to see. But instead, the growing tips, like the outer inch and a half, you know, the top inch and a half or 2 inches, which is the most succulent part, were just covered with black aphids. And so we had a little chat about that. And then I started looking around her yard, and there's aphids on the fireweed. She had a little bit of fireweed growing there, too, and that's a very common thing. She had earlier in the season, probably too early, gotten some and then released ladybugs. And she said, well, gee, I had ladybugs here. I said, yeah, well, that was a month ago, and they probably, at that time, they probably didn't find aphids to feed on. So if they don't, then off they go looking in somebody else's yard. So, you know, timing of pest control, and whether you're using beneficial insects like ladybugs, and there's some other stuff too, is really important. You got to have the pest there for the controlling insect, beneficial insect, to do some good. So, in the meantime, what we can do is get out. We've talked about using a soap spray, and that's simple, easy, cheap. and safe. So again, for the, you get a spray bottle, say you've got a 1-quart sprayer, and you can fill that with water and a teaspoon or two of liquid soap, Dawn or Joy or Dr. Bronner's, whatever you happen to prefer, and a drop or two of cooking oil. Doesn't really matter what kind. And what that does, the cooking oil helps make it a little stickier, but you need to mix it, and you need to spray it on the insects. Mm. It isn't a preventive. However, there's something called hot pepper wax, which is a kind of a liquid wax, and you can mix that with this mixture, and that does make it more of a repellent than straight killing the bugs that the spray contacts.
Hmm. Wow.
So you'll have to check with your local retailers and see if, again, I don't recall, sometimes some of these, I mean, it's a very safe item, but you get the weird, you know, you get the message if you're trying to order it from some places. We're sorry, we don't ship that to Alaska, hmm. or it can't be shipped through the post office or whatever it happens to be. So again, your choices, look to see if your local hardware stores and such have that to sell.
Hot pepper wax is what that's called.
Yep, right, and it's spicy. Yeah, I mean you definitely open the jar and you'll smell it. I mean, and you can really kind of dose, you know, mix up your own. Even if you could just get something like Tabasco sauce, and you could mix that in with your spray bottle with your soap. And a little bit of cooking oil also. Hmm. So if you're going to do that, you might actually go out online and look for recipes. I'm sure there's some of those. But again, maybe a tablespoon or two in that sprayer. Very important, don't spray into the wind. You really don't want to get this stuff in your eyes, in your face, or breathe this stuff. It would make you unhappy.
Yeah, that's pepper spray.
Exactly.
Wow. Okay. And so why does that work on the plants, and like why doesn't it harm the plants?
So, well, and that's a good question, and you really need to do a little bit of test spraying, and perhaps on just a couple of plants. The soap is actually more of a hazard to some plants, especially the really soft leaf plants. Hmm. So comparing something like lettuce to cabbage. And the cabbage leaves are quite thick, very waxy. You could spray it on. It pretty much just drips right off because they have that waxy surface. Where a lettuce leaf, and certainly the aphids like lettuce, would be one. And another one is potatoes. And again, the potatoes too can be affected by aphids, but also have a rather soft leaf with a few hairs on them. So again, you may see fairly quickly, like within a few hours, some browning of the leaves. So that's what I'm saying is if it appears that you have a lot of pests on a lot of plants, do a test spray on just one or two plants to see how the plant reacts. Hmm. And it may be a day to, you'll have to wait and see, because it may take overnight for some of this reaction to happen.
Hmm.
So you do want to be careful about how much soap. You think, oh, a little bit is good, then more must be better. Well, it's not.
Gotcha.
You can definitely damage the leaves with too much soap in your spray, in your mix.
So if you see a little bit of browning of the leaves, it's probably a matter of the dilution level is too much
exactly.
soap?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So again, try it on a plant here and a plant there. And make a note of that. Come back to it a few hours later or the next day to see that you haven't done much damage to them. And it may be that if you've got a severe pest infestation, that you may be able to tolerate some damage on the leaves, you know, to try to get rid of the pests.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. And so this works pretty well to kill the aphids and.
The aphids and the imported currant worms. So and aphids can be, you know, they're tiny. I mean, they're half a millimeter to 1 millimeter or a little bit larger. Some will have wings, some do not. They come in colors. There's green ones and pink ones and purple ones and black ones. Some with wings, some without wings. So, but again, they're tiny and usually on the growing tip. So check for that. The currant worm is a small caterpillar, and that is usually green with some black stripes or spots, speckles on it. They're a bit bigger. Well, I mean, they start out small from an egg, but then they will eventually, when they get to full mature size, they'll be half to three quarters of an inch long. And they, usually you notice the damage first. You'll see that one day you've got nice healthy currant plants or gooseberries, and the next day it seems like suddenly the leaves are almost all eaten up.
Wow.
Leaving only the center ribs of the leaves, where they've chewed out the softer parts, basically. And normally you'll see these currant worms underneath the leaves chewing away, or there's lots of more around the edges of the leaves. And certainly if you only have a few, you know, you just, you got some pest control devices attached to both hands, you just, you know, do the little quick squish. But that can, you know, if there's a lot of them, that may not work that well. But if you'd rather not spray the soap spray on them, that can work too. And again, the currant worm, it's actually a sawfly, but it's, you know, it results in a chewing caterpillar. So they overwinter as pupa, usually underneath your currant bush or gooseberry bush. That's one reason why you should do cleanup in the fall and remove leaves, rake up the soil, and hopefully some of the small birds will come along and scratch them up and maybe eat the pupas that are in the soil and in the duff underneath those plants.
Uh-huh. Hmm.
I know last week we were talking about cleaning up under raspberry plants for, again, there was more for disease than it was for pests, but still, something
idea.
We need to watch out for.
Yeah. And how about those aphids? Where are they coming from? Are they overwintering somewhere?
They're as tiny as they are. Some may overwinter as eggs. Some may overwinter as small, well, tiny adults in cracks and crevices in bark. Again, in the duff on the floor of your garden. On trees, again, depending on what kind of aphids you have, they may be just underneath the little flakes of bark on the trees where they hang out. And because they are so lightweight, there's times when we'll be walking, particularly walking underneath or past alder trees, where you'll actually see them either falling out of the tree or getting blown out of a tree and landing on us.
Oh, my.
And those are usually a green aphid, very common here.
Mm-hmm.
So just the breeze can move them. If they can crawl up into a plant or something like that, then the breeze can just blow them over onto something else.
Wow.
And then there's something else. Then there's also ants, which can tend aphids, will actually move aphids onto their preferred plant.
Wow.
The aphid will suck the juices. It's got a piercing, it pierces the skin or the leaves, sucks the juices out of it, extracts whatever it wants, and it excretes a sugary sap, which is what then the ants are going for.
Oh, my.
And you
goodness.
Might notice this stuff, the sticky stuff that they give off. If you park your car underneath an aphid infested tree, and one of the most notorious ones are the European bird cherry, Prunus patus, really, really common, or choke cherries, maybe you know them by.
Mm.
And you park your car underneath there, and you'll see on the windshield, you'll see these sticky drops that come off the tree from the aphids up in the trees.
Wow. Wow,
that pretty tough to spray something like that. I mean, considering some of these trees will get to be 30 to 40 feet tall, you know, kind of close to the size of the big alder trees around us.
Yeah, not happening.
So, again, it's, you know, there's lots of different kinds of aphids. Another plant that's common, well, I mentioned fireweed. That's really common. Mm-hmm. And that's, I've actually seen fireweeds with aphids and a few ladybugs around Juneau at least.
Hmm.
But another one, the columbines get aphids. And there's, I don't know if there's, even the buttercups. If you're pulling buttercup plants down near the base of the plant, you'll see what looks like kind of woolly, fuzzy stuff. And if you get down close, use a magnifying glass. That is actually a a woolly aphid, wow, which is feeding on the buttercups down in the sheltered areas down near the base usually.
Wow. Oh, yeah.
So there's lots and lots and lots of aphids out there.
There are. Well, let's talk more about that. I'm going to take a call here for us.
Okay.
Here we go. Line one, hello there. You are on the air. And
hey, thanks. My name is Harvey, and I have a question about roses.
Okay.
Adjacent to my yard are some roses that the blossom is pink, and it just has a single layer of petals, like five, six,
yep,
petals. And the thorns are something like 1 inch to 1.5 inches apart. And then there's some roses that are by the ferry landing here that are deep red. They also have a single layer of petals is all, but they've got stickers all up and down the end that are thick as could be. You could never get a finger between two stickers. So I'm wondering what kind of roses these two are.
Well, we've got a fair number of, well, fewer choices here than places down south. So we do, having been working up in Haines, and there's a few as you come down a little closer, but there are the wild roses, which is sometimes called the Nootka rose, or among others. They are single pink flowers, as you mentioned, and they have fairly small rose hips, moderately spiny. Then they're a really common one that does well around southeast Alaska because they are very resistant to disease. They're called rugosa roses. They're actually native to Japan, and then have been bred with others to get, so they come in white, pink, and red, singles and doubles. And if you look at the leaves of those, the leaves are really crinkly, which is what the rugose part means. But it seems like if you find a double rose, the double one seems to have more spines on those. But then you mentioned the other ones that are really spiny, and it may be rugosas. Look at the leaves. Another common one in southeast they're called red leaf rose. They have kind of smaller leaves, which have a red tinge to them. Rather red stems, and they're tall. Those will get 6 to 8 feet tall or more. And again, single pink flowers. So I'm not sure if these descriptions have helped you to decide which of these several ones. I'm sure you'll find all of those around Petersburg.
Okay.
And certainly if you go up the Stikine River or Thomas Bay and other places, you should find more of these wild roses, too. Should be up there, like growing around the cottonwoods and in the more open, sunny places along the riverbanks, too.
So these pink ones just have the single layer of petals. That's probably the Nootka rose?
I think so. Again, look at the leaves. The Nootka rose does have a smooth leaf and small hips, small being half inch, kind of elongated. The rugosa roses have big hips. I mean, those would be 1 to 1.5 inches across, kind of flattened, big red, well, orange to red in late summer, fall. So that's another distinguishing characteristic, too, are the big hips on these. And the leaves usually turn a really nice yellow color, too. So they're, and some spread underground, kind of like raspberries and salmonberries do. Some stay in fairly tight clumps. So again, you've got several choices there.
Okay, well, how about this rascal that's got these stickers and spines just solid all up and down the stem?
Yeah, depends on who these were crossed with. You know what? Who hybridized these roses? Because again, sometimes they hybridize for a nice scented rose, you know, and good hardiness, and they get the spines along for no extra charge. And then the spines may help protect them from chewing critters that chew on them, like in my neighborhood at least, porcupines will chew on the roses, and even the pretty spiny ones, surprisingly. So
these are
it's all about their family history, I guess.
The ones that have all these stickers are probably not native. They're hybrids.
Probably not. Yeah, because the Nootka rose, the native one, does have some spines, but not lots. I mean, they're scattered along the stem. They're not. Yeah, I'm not happy to be walking through them when I'm up there in Haynes moose hunting in the fall or working in the summertime either. But not as bad as some of these that I suspect you're talking about. I've seen some. I actually moved one down from my sister's place down in the Seattle area. She wanted to get rid of it pretty badly, and I could see why. It had even worse spines, more like the blackberry bushes down in the Pacific Northwest. So at least the ones around here are mostly don't have curves and hooks to them, but they're bad enough.
Okay. Well, I'm looking at the one that has the pink single layer of petals, and I'm looking at the leaves, and the leaves have got sawtooth edges, more or less.
Okay. Yep. And do they have a smooth, is the leaf smooth, or is it kind of corrugated? I guess that's almost the way to describe it. I mean, rugose is the term for it, but it's a rough surface on the leaf.
And this is pretty smooth.
Okay.
I guess it might be corrugated, but only slightly. And
yeah. Well, the other thing you could do, or get Oren here to do, get a picture. Take a picture of it, and he could, you know, if you can get a picture to him, he could text me a picture or something like that, too, and I could perhaps help you identify it that way.
Okay, well, I'll do that.
Yeah, that
okay.
Sounds good.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah,
you're welcome.
Thanks for the call, Harvey.
Okay, bye.
All right, that's fun. And we do have another call that's been waiting here, too, for a moment, so let's pop over and take another call, too, here on line three. Hello.
Hi, Oren. This is Craig Olson.
Hey there, Craig.
And our question here with Bob Nelson is, and myself is, we've got nasturtium baskets, and they're just growing great, blooming, and now the leaves start turning yellow.
Mm.
Yeah, overwatering, underwatering, fertilizing.
Balancing your watering is important, how much, and of course, you know, just if I can, assuming that I'm right next to it, I just heft the pot to see if it needs watering, you know, if it's feeling light. Mm. Of course, something you can also see is if the, you know, the plants or the leaves are wilting. So, yeah, be careful about your watering. And fertilizing is important, too, because, again, when, you know, you bought the plant, whether you bought it from a local grower or imported from down south, they certainly were fertilizing it, probably on a regular basis, like with every second or third or fourth watering. So you could do this. So when you mentioned the leaves are turning yellow, that might be an indication that they are in need of a light dose of fertilizer. And use a liquid fertilizer, you know, and there's several of those available. Read on the jar or jug or whatever you have of that material to see how much to use, and then cut it in half. And so, like this week, if you're fertilizing on Friday, or if you're watering on Friday, then give it a maybe a quarter strength. You know, if it says 2 teaspoons to a gallon of water of this fertilizer, cut that back to 1 or even a half. Give it a little dose of that fertilizer. Next time you water, just plain water. And then the time after that, again, give it a dose of this half or quarter strength fertilizer. You don't over-fertilize. That can result in too much fertilizer. You can actually burn the leaves. You know, you can actually get brown edges on the leaves is one common thing. But the yellowing, I'll ask if you look at them real carefully, are the older leaves more yellow than the younger leaves, the newer leaves?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's a pretty typical state of affairs where the new leaves are pulling nutrients from the older leaves so they can continue growing. So again, give them a light dose of fertilizer with your next watering, and then again, kind of alternate some of that, and hopefully they'll grow a bit more. Your oldest leaves may not turn back to green, but hopefully the new leaves will continue to grow and be healthier and not be stealing more of that nutrients from those.
Well, I always understood that you weren't supposed to fertilize nasturtiums. because all you'd get would be the leaves.
I thought I heard fuchsias. No, nasturtiums. Okay. Well, even less a very light dose. Don't give them more than quarter strength. But it sounds like, was there, when you planted them, did you mix any fertilizer into the soil, in the pots or whatever, where they're going?
We had Osmocote in the baskets.
Okay, so there was a little bit in there, okay.
Yep.
So just give them a very light dose and see what happens. Yeah, if you give them too much, you're going to have huge leaves. I mean, of course, you can eat the leaves, but you want flowers. So you want to be careful and even look at your fertilizer packages. So you want something that's the nitrogen, the first number. You want a low first number. The second number is phosphorus and third is potassium. The higher numbers for those will help stimulate flowering more than leaf growth. So that's what you want to look for. Say if you're using a granular fertilizer of some sort, then it may tell you how much to use in a 10-inch or 12-inch basket. Go for less. And again, if you're using a granular fertilizer, water it in as soon as you spread it on the surface or gently scratch it around it. But a very light dose, yes, for nasturtiums.
Yeah. Mm. Okay.
Thanks very much, Ed.
Okay, you're welcome.
Thanks for the call. Okay, so we got kind of a double whammy there. We got some instructions on yellowed leaves on fuchsias, and then again, and also nasturtium tending to.
Oh yeah, my nasturtiums are. We got them in late, so they're just barely sprouting. I'm hoping for a good crop again this year, and because we'll use those in salads and other assorted places too. So, not to mention they grow really well. So we'll see what happens there. One thing too on the previous fellow about roses, aphid roses are another very attractive aphid loving plant. Mm. So again, it's worth looking at those. A lot of times even on the flower buds, you'll see the little aphids of green or pink or whichever color. So again, you can use your same soap spray on those too.
Okay, roses don't mind that spray.
Nope, they're pretty good. They're pretty hardy. And again, particularly the rugosa type roses with that rough surface leaf, they are normally very resistant to other, not so much pests, but other diseases, which is one reason why they're often used in breeding with other kinds of roses.
Gotcha.
Because of their disease resistance.
Okay. Well, and I've got another question here, too. This one comes live in the studio from our next host on the air, the one and only Lars Christensen, going to host Country Music Next, and he's here. I'm sliding his mic up there now. Are you coming in, Lars?
Yep.
Okay.
You hear me?
Yep.
Hi, Ed.
Good afternoon, Lars.
Yeah, I'm coming off the injured reserve list, so I didn't plant anything this year, but my fruit trees, since I've left everything alone, my fruit trees have gone crazy. All my apple and cherry trees all blossomed at the same time in May. And now I got all sorts of apples and cherries. Except what worries me is I think I have way too many apples on my apple trees. I've read somewhere you should thin them out if you got too many. Is there any sense to that?
Yeah, exactly. I do when I can. I mean, my trees are small enough that I can reach many or most of them, luckily, because I've got dwarf or semi-dwarf trees. I get a big one, it's pretty tough. But you can even go out there just and shake the tree, literally shake the tree or shake branches, and you'll see a lot of the little ones will fall off anyway, because it's really how many fruit your tree can support is based on how much food, fertility, soil is there. And certainly we kind of expected a really good flowering year for fruits and berries. We're saying the same thing. I mean, the blueberry bushes are loaded with berries around me, green berries. So it looks promising because we had a really nice summer last year.
Mm-hmm.
You can, or, you know, you talk about thinning, for the cherries, you can do the same thing. Just shake them hard and shake them a couple of times, like once a week or something like that to reduce numbers. Because what happens if they have a really big crop this year, and even if we do have a really nice sunny summer, they're using up a lot of energy that then they may go to alternate year bearing, so next year have a very low crop.
Uh-huh.
Again, last year we had a low crop,
yep.
But then we had good summer, good sunshine, leading to a really good flowering, and hopefully the fruit will ripen well if we get sun later in the summer. So yes, thinning, you can go out for the apples, just either with a pair of scissors or just pinch off fruits. So like you look at a branch, and commercially they have a rule of thumb that's supposed to be 40 leaves to one fruit. I don't know that you're going to be out there counting leaves on your branches, but they actually do physically thin fruit, and they also have some kind of a spray that I'm not sure what it is, that they actually can spray the trees, which makes the tree drop a certain or percentage of the fruit. So you can go out there and just clip off some of them. So if you see a flower cluster that's got 3 or 4 or 5 apples on it, clip that down to just one apple on there, so you're not getting big clusters of them.
Oh, yeah.
As impressive as that looks, but it may result in you having lots and lots of small apples versus fewer big apples.
I have endless clusters, and there's 5, 6, 7, 8 and on all of them. And then last year, I got a real, real low quantity of apples, but I had my biggest and best apples ever.
Right.
You wouldn't believe how many apples are out there now.
Too many.
Oh yes, I would.
Yeah.
I mean, my trees are looking really good too, and if I can keep the bears out of them, I'll be happy with that. But we'll see how it goes. I'll get my electric fence up earlier this year,
and
hopefully the bears
question.
Will find enough fruit in the forest that they won't come after my apples in my yard.
Well, I see the salmon berries are absolutely gone nuts around their yard.
Yep.
But I was wondering, I plant in the same area every year because I don't have a whole lot of yard to plant in, so I'm not planting anything because I've been injured all spring. And isn't it good, they say like every 5-7 years to give your ground a break anyway?
Well, you can do that, or you can just mix in compost and mix in other good stuff into that soil, and then throw a black tarp over it, or a blue tarp, or whatever your favorite color of tarp happens to be, green tarp maybe. But just to keep the weeds down, don't let the weeds grow out there, because they're going to steal what nutrients might have been left there. But and another thing you can do too, whether you mix in a little bit of fertilizer, compost, whatever you've got, seaweed, all that sort of thing in the fall, cover it back up again, and let the worms do the work, because the worms will help break down some of that material. And you can also plant cover crops, and I don't know if there's anybody sells any cover crop seed there, which the intent there is you plant some of these, and normally they've got some kind of a grass, and so the stuff that I'm planting has oats, has winter peas, and fava beans, and vetch. So you actually have 3 nitrogen-fixing crops. So you plant this stuff, you just rake, you literally just sprinkle it on the surface, rake it in, and it sprouts quickly, grows fast, and I will normally then chop it down and cover it back up with a tarp after about, maybe 6 or 8 weeks of growth. So, and if you can mix it into the soil, even better, because it is improving your soil, holding on to the nutrients that you may have there already, and makes the soil better for next year when you're not going to be doing, if you're not doing stuff now, or if you can, I guess, maybe need to hire somebody to do this for you, perhaps, but at least do cover the soil so that all the stuff that floats in on the breeze, the dandelions and everything else, isn't going to colonize that bare soil.
No, that was my plan, to put that black, whatever you call it, stuff over it.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
One more question.
Yeah, do that. I mean, if you've got some clean grass clippings, grass clippings that do not have, has not been used, no weed and feed on it, and you or the neighbor, if they're doing that, lift up your tarp, throw some of that, throw a layer of that on there, cover it back up again, and the worms will be happy. They'll work on that stuff for you, and again, they'll be improving your soil while you sleep.
I have a lot of grass clippings, but it has buttercups and stuff in it. Will that make any difference?
Yeah, that's iffy. I mean, if they're not flowering, you know, if you mow and they're not flowering, you could probably use them. But yeah, that's one thing you want to be careful about, is not putting grass clippings in with weed seeds in them too. So again, it's all about timing, I guess. Same thing. Yeah, you don't want to throw in. I guess probably most of the dandelions are done. But the same thing there, you know, you don't want to be throwing in chopped up dandelion seed heads, because they will sprout or wait for the right conditions to sprout too.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, how are your strawberries doing? Mine are doing great, but they're waiting for some sunshine.
Yeah, the variety is called Seascape, is the variety I got some of this year. I put them all in hanging baskets. And so, in fact, there's probably, I can go down and they're hanging in my hoop house, which is open-ended but warm. And they're flowering up a storm, and we're eating strawberries now. So I'm enjoying a handful here and a handful there from, I think I've only got 8 or 10 baskets. But that's enough for a nice taste.
Yeah, mine are all growing in the ground, and they're doing great, but without some sunshine, I don't know how well they're going to finish up.
Right. Well, there is that. And then, of course, trying to keep the slugs out of them, too, you know. So, you know, if you're using slug bait or otherwise in there to try to keep the slugs from eating the strawberries also.
I think I have the only yard in southeast Alaska that doesn't have a slug problem. I can't believe it.
I don't know if I do either. That sounds like a fairy tale to me.
Yeah, I can't believe it. Everybody's always complaining about their slugs, and I might find one in a great wild.
Oh boy. Well,
amazing.
that sounds really good. However you manage that, better keep doing it.
Well, it's nothing to do with me.
Well, that's it's been a good slug-free ride while it lasted, but the little slug antennae have all started twitching. They're all
moseying
towards Lars's lawn as we speak.
We have. I've been finding slugs and stomping slugs as I go. So, and I'm using slug bait now. So,
what do you use for slug bait?
I get after them for whether it be on cabbages, lettuce, dahlias, and other stuff. The slugs are out there.
Oh yeah, yeah. We're gonna see them because we've just had these last couple of days of rain, and then sun's gonna shine tomorrow. Maybe a little this weekend. Yeah, get ready. Yeah, I think, Lars, did you just ask what's good slug bait? Maybe we'll have that be the final question of the session here.
Yeah, certainly beer works, and you can even just make sugar, water, and yeast will work also. And whether you have some little, you know, you can make your own little holders, containers, cottage cheese containers with little holes in the side. You put some of the stuff in the bottom, some of the liquid material in the bottom. A little bit of, you know, cheap beer. Of course, it's hard to find cheap beer anymore.
Isn't that alcohol abuse?
There's not much of that around. And
like that,
if you're going to buy some slug bait, as far as safety goes, safety for other critters, Sluggo or Worry Free are a couple of products that I like. It's iron phosphate. It breaks down to be a fertilizer. You do want to keep it kind of, well, drier. Tuck it underneath chunks of boards or flat rocks or old shingles or other assorted stuff, or in containers too. And the slugs will definitely be attracted to that and eat it and then die. And it's not harmful to birds and dogs and other critters out in the yard too.
Okay, so that was Worry Free or Sluggo.
Sluggo is the commonest one. There are several. The escargot is another one, and they all have this iron phosphate. It looks like little white or cream-colored pellets of the stuff. You know, it's about 1 by 3 millimeters or so. I was just spreading some of mine around my corn. The corn is being chewed by slugs, and I do not approve of that. So, I mean, I'm still dreaming here, so I'll let you know if it makes it to knee-high by the 4th of July.
Yeah, keep us posted. Corn Watch 2019.
Okay.
Well, so this is probably a good time of year for folks to be doing some, keeping an eye out for slugs, acting proactively rather than letting it turn out to be a huge slug year at the end of the season in your whole gardens. A slug feast. Put some slug bait out there. Have a party. Leave some scattered beer bottles around.
That's right. I don't know if you can go down to the bar and at the end of the night you can go in there with your bucket and just empty the empty the half fill glasses or whatever at closing time. You can try it.
They might not let us, but we can make a case. This is
can,
for
well,
slugs.
You can provide them with a bucket that they could dump it into. How about that? Maybe they would do that. I don't know.
Maybe.
Okay. Then and you label it appropriately, slug bait on the outside.
Yeah, that's the Keto's closing time slug bait is when you get a slug in the belly.
Please donate to some gardener, some needy gardener that needs more slug bait.
Well, it's a worthwhile idea, but you know, definitely a good note to end on. This is a great time of year to be out there taking care of pests, looking for your aphids, spraying them with a diluted soap, cooking oil, like a drop of oil, a teaspoon of soap to a quart of water, spraying that directly on the aphids when you find them. And then maybe if you're seeing slugs, set some traps, whatever way you like, and stay proactive. Shake the apple blooms out of the tree. Less is more with apples. And that's our recap here.
Okay. Good job.
All right. Well, we'll leave it here. Thank you so much, Ed, for taking the time to share your expertise with us. We're going to hand things over to Lars here for country music coming up next. And thanks, everybody, for calling in, too. It's great in the garden. And
till next week, Gordon.
Till next week. All right. Sounds good. There you go. In the garden, ladies and gentlemen. Huge thank you to Master Gardener Ed Bajarski for sharing his expertise. It takes a lot of work and a lot of sharing of good ideas to have a productive garden out here in the temperate rainforest, but it's well worth it. About the best way you could be using your land at your house there. So good luck to everybody out there growing food and growing flowers and enjoying your gardens. And we want to thank the Flower Farm for helping support this program. Their last day of the season for the Garden Center on Haugen Drive is this Saturday. And then out at Papke's Landing, Flower Farm operating as usual. Dahlias in bloom. Bouquet subscriptions and delivery available out at the Flower Farm. They're open every day, but Wednesday 10 to 5 at 6 Roy's Road, Papke's Landing. All right. Coming up next, High Country Music with Lars Christensen. Put them in a stew, you can make your very own tomato juice. You can eat them with eggs, you can eat them with gravy. Eat them with beans, pinto or navy. Put them on a side, put them in the middle. Put a homegrown tomato on a hot can griddle. Homegrown tomatoes, homegrown tomatoes. What would life be without homegrown tomatoes? Only two things that money can't buy, and that's true love and homegrown tomatoes. Tomato seed, 'cause I know what this country needs. It's homegrown tomatoes in every yard you see. When I die, don't bury me in a box in a cemetery. Out in the garden, be much better, and I could be pushing homegrown tomatoes. Homegrown tomatoes, homegrown tomatoes, homegrown tomatoes. What'd life be without homegrown tomatoes? Only two things that money can't buy, and that's true love. Homegrown tomatoes. Homegrown tomatoes. What'd life be without homegrown tomatoes? Only two things that money can't.